You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, October 6, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, professor of political science from Williams College, author of Overreach, Delusions of Regime Change in Iraq, Michael McDonald, will join us also on the program today. Marriage equality, all but legal, just about everywhere, folks. Supreme Court denies cert for every appeal of the vacating of stays in two major circuits. What does all that mean? Cats and dogs living together, folks. Protect your marriages, because now any two people in love with each other who are not related can get married. In many states. Not all as of yet, but surprising refusal to weigh in by the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, a city in the northern part of Syria, Kobane, primed to fall as Syrian Kurds are prepared to fight to the death, essentially, in the streets. Meanwhile, Turkey seems not terribly interested in getting involved, even though it's on their border. Good news is defense stocks are up, folks. Job numbers are also up, however, middle class still losing. Andrew Cuomo apparently meddled not only in the Moreland Commission, but also in the development of a report about fracking. And the fight over the AP curriculum in Colorado continues, and a clearer sense of just how demented and deluded, I guess, some members of the Colorado Board of Education, in fact, are. All that and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, I am sick and tired. Period. I am sick and I am tired. So if my energy is a little bit off today, apologies. Just a reminder, we're going to play this interview with Michael McDonald that I recorded at the end of last week. Today, you have not heard it as of yet. A couple of house cleaning notes. Housekeeping, house cleaning. We submitted our fix to the iOS 8 app nearly 2 weeks ago now, and we're still waiting for Apple to post it. It has disabled most features of our Apple app. However, if you have not upgraded to iOS 8, which I'm not even convinced is an upgrade at this point, or if you have an Android smartphone, pick up our app at majorityapp.com. It's free, and when the update comes, it'll be working well for everyone. Also, a reminder, this show relies on your support. We can't do it without you. Can't do the free daily show without you. Can't do the member show without you. Can't do any of it without you. If you have the financial means to become a member, please join today at majority.fm. You can also support this program buying your coffee at justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. It's great coffee, great company, win-win-win. Get the Majority Report blend. You'll love it. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do, frankly, Jeff Bezos, how much richer can the guy get? Buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. You just click on the link. You buy what you want to buy. You will notice no difference. Or you can click on the link, bookmark it. That way you remember every time you go to Amazon, you go through that link on your bookmark, and we get a kickback. Hence, majorityreportkickback.com. Also, a reminder, tomorrow on the program, we will have an interview that I will record, Matt and Mike, with two interviews. One is going to be on, from Lawrence Lessig. I believe we're going to run this tomorrow. There's going to be an announcement tomorrow, and we will run an interview with him that we will do in anticipation of that announcement. Also, we will be talking to Eugenia Williamson, who did a piece for Harper's on the self-destruction of PBS. Matt and Mike will do the better half tomorrow. They will also be doing Wednesday's show. I am en route to cover the Mass Torts Conference in Vegas on Thursday and Friday. I will be live from there as we are wont to do once or twice a year. And that is all. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Michael McDonald on his book Overreach, Delusions of Regime Change in Iraq. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Political Science at Williams College and author of the just released Overreach, Delusions of Regime Change in Iraq, Professor Michael McDonald. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Well, thank you, Sam. It's great to be here.
Very timely, of course, your book, which I imagine is somewhat coincidental, but of course, with the rise of ISIS and in many respects the fall, or at least the weakening of the central government in Iraq. Before we get into, let's work our way up to what's happening today, because your your book describes sort of the, well, I guess the delusions of many who supported the Iraq invasion. Let's start with what those of us who were against the war and the invasion from the beginning and may have contemplated why this ended up happening. List for us those, I guess, motivations that we ascribe to the Bush administration and our establishment at large, those motivations which are, in your opinion, wrong.
Well, I don't think any of the motivations ascribed to the Bush administration by the critics are wrong exactly. I think that there's more going on, and the motivations that are ascribed are incomplete. I do think Bush might have had issues around his father, and I do think certainly the U.S. had an interest in the oil. And I do think there's something to the claim that the U.S. was interested in helping Israel. But I think most importantly what the United States was trying to do under the Bush administration is project American power into the region, first, and second, more broadly, kind of create the conditions for the neoliberalization of the Middle East. The Bush administration, like the Clinton administration before it, was committed to a version of globalization that wanted to marketize the world. And one of the reasons that it held out most tenaciously against that version of marketization was the Middle East. I think what the U.S. was trying to do was use state power, American military power, to open up the region for a kind of neoliberal marketization while at the same time projecting American power into the region. And I think those kind of geopolitical, geostrategic, geoeconomic objectives encompass the narrower concerns with oil and whatnot.
Yeah, the argument at the very least is reminiscent of a piece that I remember Naomi Klein wrote. Maybe it was 10 years ago. I think it the name escapes me off the top of my head, but it's I think it was Baghdad Year Zero or something right. to that effect, outlining this neoconservative and neoliberal, I guess, project of making a free market Garden of Eden in Iraq.
Yeah, I think she was right about a lot of stuff. I think it's interesting that her kind of insight into the deeper structural forces tended to be overlooked even by the worst critics. But yeah, I think the idea was to remake the Middle East. I mean, Bush was quite clear on that. He kept talking about remaking the Middle East. He often used the language of democracy and liberalization. But what democracy and liberalization meant for Bush was some kind of liberalization, and liberalization meant fundamentally capitalism, and capitalism meant organizing society on the basis of markets. And you know, Bush was wrong about a lot of particulars, but I don't think he fundamentally misrepresented the deeper what he saw as a deeper historic significance of the Middle East. What they were fundamentally wrong about, what they simply did not understand, was that if you broke the state in Iraq, you were going to open up Pandora's box, to mix metaphors. I mean, one of the things that's really striking about the war for me is the extent to which the neocons and the hawks signaled the chaos that would ensue. One of their core arguments, they make it time and again, and it comes from an important Iraqi dissident, is that Saddam governed Iraq as if Saddam was the warden of a prison. He turned Iraqi against Iraqi. He encouraged informing. He attacked social ties. He attacked the kinds of normal human connections that people developed. He deliberately disorganized society so that society could not turn on him. In that sense, they argue that Iraq was like a jail and Saddam was like a warden. Well, what happens if you kill the warden in the prison? We get a jailbreak. The very kind of metaphors used by hawks to encourage the war suggested that chaos would ensue, and chaos ensued. And then what happens is the U.S. is both, many hawks are overwhelmed by the chaos, it was simply unexpected, and others try to make a virtue of necessity and use that as a kind of way to deepen American involvement in the region to correct the kinds of problems that the U.S. helped instigate. Look at the number of times, for example, hawks, neoconservatives in particular, called upon the U.S. to help help with a reformation of Islam. They kept using the language of a reformation. Well, look at the reformation in Europe. It precipitates the 30 Years' War. The 30 Years' War is one of the bloodiest wars in European history. The language the neocons kept using implied the destruction they were unleashing. And then they were rather surprised by what they had wrought. It's a weird paradox. They kind of predicted what would happen and then were surprised when the predictions came true.
I want to circle back to that notion of what would happen and what they knew would happen if mm-hmm. they deposed Saddam Hussein. But let's but before we get there, let's split up this notion, because one of the things with when it became clear that ISIS was really overrunning, I guess, Western Iraq and had essentially captured Mosul, one of the things that struck me, and you know, at the time I was in my early radio days, suggesting that this was, you know, we were creating the context for something like this, that the invasion itself, because one of the things that we hear in the wake of what ISIS has done in Iraq is that really this can be tied back to failures and mistakes of the occupation as opposed to the invasion itself. And give me your take on that as to whether or not it was baked into the cake when we invaded and overthrew Saddam, that the subsequent failures were sort of preordained.
Well, just take a few steps back in history. When the League of Nations decides that Britain gets what becomes Iraq, the British deliberately established a weak government because they did not want the government in Iraq to be able to challenge British interests. Fast forward 40 years, you have 50 years, you have Saddam taking over, and he has this sort of gargantuan state with the military and mansions and parades and statues and all that, but he has very little actual positive loyalty towards the regime. You then have the U.S. come in and breaks the state. Specifically, it attacks Saddam, it removes Saddam, it abolishes the army, and it begins to purge the state administration of senior officials. In other words, the U.S. breaks the state. That was what regime change meant. It meant you first got rid of the state, and then you hoped that either something would be built in its stead or something would spontaneously emerge in its stead. Disorder was built into the project. Now, what happens is, and when the U.S. starts trying to understand, or more specifically, when policymakers who were now implicated in the chaos that had become Iraq were trying to figure out what was going on, they contrive an explanation that essentially absolves them of responsibility. You see this, and it comes out of the military, it comes out of the CIA, it comes out of the foreign policy establishment, it comes out of American political elites, the various constituencies that had pushed for the war with Bush and independently of Bush. Remember, the U.S. was calling for regime change in Iraq in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
The war is not launched until 2003. There's a 4.5-year period where the official policy of the U.S. government is regime change in Iraq. A lot of people supported the war prior to and independently of Bush. When the war goes wrong, they want to escape blame. So what their argument becomes essentially is that the problem with what was going on in Iraq was the way Bush fought the war, not the project of the war itself. So you get all these arguments that the problem with the war was bad planning. You get all these arguments that the problem with the war was insufficient, with the occupation was an insufficient number of troops. Those points might be true.
Or that it was de-bathification, that it was Paul Bremer.
Or de-bathification, or Bremer, or Bush didn't know the difference between Sunnis and Shia. And all these things may be true, but there's a logical fallacy in arguing that because the war was fought badly, it would have succeeded if it fought well.
Right.
If it had been fought well. And that logical fallacy serves the incredible importance of getting basically a generation of American hawks off the hook, right? They're not accountable for their decision to support the war because it was a good decision. The problem was they could not envision just how stupid and how clueless and how inept Bush would be. One guy who makes this point repeatedly is Joe Biden. He keeps saying things like, I wouldn't have supported the war if I knew how dumb Bush had been. But I didn't fully appreciate the depths of his incompetence. And so I'm not really responsible for the way Bush misled the country. All that assumes is that if the U.S. had fought the war more competently, it would have turned out well, and hawks would have been vindicated for their hawkishness. I mean, Bush serves a wonderful role as the excuse for a series of policymakers who can blame their mistakes on his incompetence. And that's not to say he was competent. It's not to say that his incompetence was not the decisive factor.
And let's just, you know, to sort of highlight that logical fallacy, let's just reiterate for us or examine for us, when we say regime change, we're not talking just go in and get rid of Saddam, right?
Uday and his other son.
Right. We're talking about, regime change necessarily means debathification, right? And we didn't. I really want to dig into this because there's nothing that drives me nuts more than the idea, well, if only we hadn't gone through debathification. But debathification was exactly the project, right?
Well, but part of the problem is they didn't agree on what regime change meant. There were clearly people, neocons and neoliberals, who understood regime change to mean changing the structure of the Iraqi state and the relation of the Iraqi state to Iraqi society. And that entailed regime change. That entailed debathification. There's more minimalists, especially in the U.S. intelligence agencies and the military, who understand regime change more narrowly. It means getting rid of Saddam and plopping some other Sunni strongman in power, preferably somebody who will get along better with Saudi Arabia. Those people would say, gee, the problem was debathification, the problem was disbanding the army. The problem with their argument is they had argued already that what held the society together was Saddam terrified. The people, Saddam terrified the military, Saddam terrified the Shia, Saddam terrified the Kurds. Their argument suggests that simultaneously you can remove Saddam and preserve order. That doesn't work if what was maintaining order was the fear Saddam instilled. That's the kind of problem with the kind of vision of regime change that was accepted by the military and the CIA. They thought you could essentially preserve the state while changing the leader without having a state that's held together by fear of Saddam give way to an uprising from below by Shia and Kurds, which is essentially what happened in 1991 when Saddam had been chased out of Kuwait by the U.S. The rising from below by the Shia threatened the regime, and the U.S. became afraid that this would amount to an Iranian victory, and Bush Sr. kind of let Saddam do what he must do in order to maintain power. The more expansive versions of regime change, which are coming from the Democratic Party as well as neoconservatives, necessarily entailed breaking the Ba'ath Party. That's what it was about. That was the regime that was to be changed. And what they never sorted through was how you were going to break the Ba'ath Party without unleashing disorder, especially in a society that had been traumatized by 30 years of Saddam or 20 years of Saddam.
And to expand upon that, it seems to me, too, that it may be the case that certain elements of the military or the national security state perceived regime change to be that limited. But that also ran into conflict with the way that you sell this to the American public, right? I mean, because if it was just about Saddam Hussein, well, then why can't we send a couple of Tomahawk cruise missiles and just keep chasing this guy around the country?
And if it's just about Saddam Hussein, you don't achieve the broader kind of geopolitical objectives of increasing American power and the neoliberal objectives of reorganizing Iraq as a prelude to reorganizing the whole region.
But let me separate that because it seems to me, and just so that we can be clear, it seems to me that there are sort of so many different levels as to what reasons for invasion were. And I think it was Wolfowitz who said at one point, like, well, we all agreed on weapons of mass destruction because that was the one thing we could agree on. Yes. And I think that signified the different sort of policy aspirations that were involved in the Obama administration, Freudian Bush slip, but perhaps more telling than it should be. But the Bush administration, ranging from that we're going to have this free market paradise there, we have a geopolitical stake, it's important for us to have this base so that we're close to Saudi Arabia. Maybe there were some people who actually thought this is going to help with terrorism, which I find hard to believe, and George Bush wanted to avenge his dad. Whatever it was, that mix there. And then there's the sort of the buy-in from the Democratic Party in many respects, I'll be generous and say just the hawks, and then the buy-in from the Thomas Friedmans of the world, and then there's what the United, you know, the general population. We were at 60-70% when in favor of invading Iraq at that time, and the policy. The beliefs of the policy aspirations of the American public, I think, were just more, were less specific than those of the neoliberals and the neocons in the administration and in the establishment. So, when we talk about that, that sales job, it seems to me you couldn't sell to the American public. This is just about toppling Saddam Hussein.
Well, you couldn't sell that just to the American public. And frankly, I don't think you can sell that to the American elites. They didn't want just some wanted Saddam gone for personal reasons and because Saddam was an especially unsavory leader. But you don't, this war did not start, this war was not initiated by public opinion. This was a war sold by elite opinion to the American people.
Right.
You mentioned Tom Friedman. I think Friedman's an excellent example of that. Friedman insists all along that the war is not really about WMDs. It's not really about Al-Qaeda. The reason you need the war is that Muslims are angry with the U.S. And the reason they're angry with the U.S. is because Muslims are powerless. And the reason Muslims are powerless, and he borrows this argument directly from Bernard Lewis, the very influential scholar of Islam, at Princeton. The reason Muslims are angry at the U.S. is because, and the West, is because Muslims are powerless and the West is powerful. The reason why Muslims are powerless is fundamentally because they don't have secularization. Secularism is a source of power. We have it. They don't. The only way, therefore, to ameliorate their hostility to the West is to transform them. They have to become like us. And since they are the problem, they cannot turn themselves into us. We must do the turning for them. And so what you get is this sort of aspiration for a cultural revolution imposed from without on Islam by the U.S., which is supposed to start in Iraq and then radiate through the Muslim world. It's an extraordinarily ambitious conception, is highly naive. It knows very little about how social change works, but it kind of assumes that we get to remake them, and they, on the one hand, will be unhappy at being powerless and being remade, but on the other hand, will be grateful once the process is completed. In the meantime, you break the state, you break most social institutions, because that's what it means to remake them, right? It's not as if they're being oppressed by an alien state in this conception. The problem is who they have become. And the only way to make them happy with a world that will be dominated by American power and liberal institutions and modernization and secularism is to make them modern, secular, market participating, instrumentally rational, marginal utility maximizing individuals. And they can't make themselves into that. They have to be made that way by the U.S. And what's extraordinary about this kind of hawkish argument is they thought simultaneously we could break structures of control, remake them, and they would be happy to become what we turned them into being when they didn't want to be that in the first place, which is why they were hating us.
And the irony, of course, about choosing Iraq to start that project is that you were talking about one of the most secular because of what you've described in terms of the way that Saddam Hussein ruled, one of the more secular and more advanced, I guess, states in that region. But that seems to me to be secondary to the idea that that guys, particularly like Thomas Friedman, had this notion. I mean, it really is, in some level, a missionary perspective. And you talk quite a bit in your book about this notion of, this is what American exceptionalism is.
Yeah. What American exceptionalism is, I think, for these people is the idea. The reason America is exceptional for these people is that the U.S., unlike other countries, has ideals built into its identity as core interests. Liberal ideals, ideals of markets, ideals of rights, ideals of freedom are core American interests. And our ideals, because they're liberal, are universal. So what these guys do, essentially, is they say we get to act on our interests, which are liberal and universal and therefore emancipatory, and therefore welcome in Iraq or wherever the U.S. projects power. And at the same time, they get to say that, well, because these ideals need to be materialized by American power, you have the need to expand, even universalize American power, but it's not going to be experienced as the assertion of power. It's going to be experienced by Iraqis or whoever as emancipatory. So you get to be exceptional because America, unlike other countries for these people, doesn't have to balance off ideals with interests. They turn their interests into ideals, universalize their ideals, and then require the universalization of American power in order to liberate people. And on the one hand, this sounds like sheer propaganda, but that's what I think really is the delusion. And the evidence is a delusion and not sheer propaganda is the U.S. prepared for an in-and-out affair. They didn't. The American military planners, acting under the instructions of the civilian leadership,
right.
This is quite clear, were told this is going to be a short invasion, do not prepare for a long occupation, and they organized troop rotations and whatnot accordingly.
And if I recall correctly, that's why Shinseki was fired, right? I mean, Shinseki was fired because he basically said, this is nuts.
Anybody who said this was nuts disappeared.
Right.
Yeah. Rumsfeld made it clear he didn't want to hear it. And Rumsfeld was less delusional about this, by the way, than most of the other civilian leaders. Rumsfeld kind of basically understood it was going to be a nasty process and thought you'd end up with a strong man. And then Bush essentially overrules him and says, no, you're going to have elections and this, that, and the other. And Rumsfeld says, basically, how dare you? I'm the Secretary of Defense. But I think the reason it's delusion as opposed to propaganda is these people believed it. And as a result, they didn't understand what was going on when the anarchy, the statelessness and the anarchy they created generated disorder rather than some kind of liberal flowering. It's kind of bizarre to describe because a lot of this happens semi-consciously, but it was guiding their real political, diplomatic calculations.
Thomas Friedman, over the past 10 or so odd years, has been, and listeners of this program will know this, has been, I've been at various times somewhat obsessed with Thomas Friedman's, and I don't perspective on the war, and I know his interview with Charlie Rose, I think in 2004, by heart, where he sort of had mutated into spreading freedom into we needed to pop their asymmetric bubble we needed to pop their delusion that they could get away with this. And it just so happened we chose Iraq because we could. But I think he was one of those guys who was genuinely deluded. But, of course, your delusion is much easier when you don't actually have to insert yourself into the reality of the situation, right? I mean, it's much easier to be deluded sitting in Charlie Rose's studio about the implications of what's going to happen or has happened, far less so, I guess, when you actually have to head over there.
Well, I think also, I think more broadly, one of the real kind of facilitating factors is that almost everybody who thought this war was a bright idea was located in Washington. And Washington is one of the most highly institutionalized societies in the history of the world. There's rules on how to suck up to people. There's rules on who to suck up to. There's rules. I mean, it's an extraordinarily institutionalized kind of hierarchy. And Iraq was an extraordinarily deinstitutionalized society. That's what Saddam did. He broke institutions lest those institutions be organized against him. And what you had are these people who populated D.C., who thought, for example, that Cheney had gravitas and insight because he kind of spoke in a slow growl. These people who just institutionalized, who assumed institutions, look at the society that has few, break those that remain, and then are surprised at what the absence of institutions breeds. I don't think, for example, the kinds of American statesmen reorganizing the West after World War II would have made any of these mistakes. And the reason is almost all of them had experience in the world outside D.C., whereas almost all the civilian leaders who were hawks who drove this war were creatures of Washington.
Interesting. And so let's circle back to that notion of what the different agendas. I mean, we've talked a little bit about this. Sort of, there was multiple agendas. They all came together. There were some that, as you broadened out from these concentric circles, I guess, that supported this push to war. And you talk about those, those broader goals of that emanate from this the sense of American exceptionalism. Let me suggest, or let me test this theory on you. Now, we know that Dick Cheney in 1994, I think there was a fairly well-known interview that I think he gave for ABC, where he was justifying why Herbert Walker Bush did not go in and take Baghdad. And he basically said, you can't go in there because you'll create a Sunni-Shia divide, you will destroy the institutions. I mean, he basically said what would happen, or guessed what would happen, and I think pretty much got it right. Nevertheless, 9 years later, he is leading the charge to do just that. And my theory has been, and it may be different for a guy like Bush, but I think from Cheney's perspective in particular, that this outcome was not necessarily the optimal outcome, but it was in a range of preferred outcomes because they felt that that if you look back in the Project for New American Century, there was basically the white paper of perceiving a new global order where the U.S. is a hyperpower. And really, to maintain the hyperpower status is you allow for a lot of small regional conflicts, and you sit back and you let people sort of busy themselves with each other. But they also simultaneously wanted a geopolitical presence there by hook or crook. And I sort of feel like, or my sense is that Dick Cheney, even when you wake him up in the morning, in the middle of the night, and it's not about delusion, and it's not about, he's like, this is a better situation for the United States going forward.
You know, I've never understood Cheney as well as I think I have come to understand the others. You might be right. One of the things that's different about Cheney than the others is he doesn't seem to be particularly concerned with the notions of liberalization, marketization, neoliberalization. He's trying to project American power. And it might be that he decides that broken states are better for the U.S. than cohesive states, even unjust ones. And I don't think Cheney cared at all about the unjustness of any state. What I think he fundamentally didn't understand, and this might be a function of his racism, is that they assume, one of the neocon assumptions is that Arabs cower before power. This is a theme that consistently recurs. You say, somebody says you're going to invade, they're going to be upset, and they go, well, they may be upset, but the Arab respects power above all else. A lot of neocons say that, they repeat that. I think Cheney believed that. Cheney also is worth mentioning, was meeting frequently with Bernard Lewis in these years, especially after 9/11. And Lewis is the key author of the claim that the problem with the Mideast, the problem with Arabs is Islam. And the problem with Islam is it can't deal with secularization and modernity. And kind of Lewis blends in to the argument that what you need is a cultural revolution akin to the Reformation. And as a very eminent religious historian, he knew full well what the Reformation meant in Europe. But Lewis also always has this kind of sense that there's this good Arab. You'll pick this up in Tom Friedman articles too, columns too. There's this good Arab waiting to become like us. And I think that Cheney kind of picked up on the kind of, yeah, they sort of want us there, but mostly they're afraid of American power. If we move in and we shock and awe and we show the full military might of the U.S. and we show especially that we're not afraid to use it, then they'll submit.
But I gotta say that Cheney nailed it as to what would happen. I'm still quite convinced that if any of that happened, I'm sure he would have been happy with it. But I'm quite convinced that in this day and age, he still feels like this is a good situation. Because I do think that, I mean, look, if we look at what we know that he was talking about Iraq all through the 90s, we can see the documents that specifically talk about Iraq as a linchpin, that talk about the oil reserves. I think it was less about getting cheap oil for the United States and more about we're going to control the spigot from so that China can't get a hold of this, because
Cheney's
obsessed with China, as far as I can tell. And you have a guy there who's basically like, when they came into office in 2000, it was not about those non-state actors like Osama bin Laden that was the concern. It was the rogue states. And so what's better than a rogue state? A fractured, state that really isn't cohesive enough to go rogue.
Well, there's another way to take this, which is Iraq really was just the first of a combination shot, that what the U.S. wanted to do was move into Iraq and then soon thereafter move into Iran. And actually, Tony Blair in his memoirs, and remember, Blair not only supports the war, he supports these justifications for the war. Blair effectively says that that's what Cheney wanted. First Iraq, then Iran. So it's maybe less about just breaking state power than a bold move to eliminate both of America's main enemies, at least Cheney's main enemies, in that region. And what they radically miscalculated was the impact of the invasion of Iraq on Iraq. But if you assume that the purpose was not just to break Iraq, but to project American power, and the real prize wasn't Iraq but Iran, then the missing link becomes the assumption that the U.S. would capture Iraq, Iraqis would submit, Iran would begin to challenge that, and Iran's challenges to America's newfound hegemony in Iraq would constitute the pretext for the extension of regime change to Iran. And then you end up with everything. And then you can do your kind of energy spigot thing with China, Europe, and anybody else who gets in America's way or Cheney's way.
So briefly, when you see what is happening in Iraq today and now our expanded involvement not only in Iraq but in Syria, where does that leave us? Where does that where do we go from here?
Where will the U.S. go? I think the basic problem for the U.S. is ISIS is filling the vacuum of statelessness. The key American argument, the kind of link between the late Bush administration, Petraeus and Obama, is the idea that sectarianism causes conflicts and state clashes. I think that you might want to reverse it and argue that statelessness increases sectarianism, and if you want to, if you're worried about ISIS, the response is fundamentally to develop stronger state powers instead of the statelessness that is now engulfing large chunks of Iraq and significant chunks of Syria. I think what the U.S. is going to try to do is plant its flag in, no pun intended, the shifting sands of an area where there's not there's no solid subsoil. The U.S. will do what it must do to fight ISIS, but will not have will not be able to develop the kind of counters that it will need in order really to defeat either ISIS or its successors, which is some kind of viable state. And if the U.S. can't undo, and I don't think it can undo, the kind of damage it contributed to from 2003 onward. And let's, one other point I should make, it doesn't just start with Bush in 2003. I mean, the economic sanctions on Iraq were devastating in the 1990s. I mean, they shrink the economy to 20% of its pre-sanction level. They drove out the middle class. They destroy the formal economy. The society had been hollowed out by Saddam and by sanctions separately prior to the invasion. The invasion then breaks the state. And what's going on now in Western Iraq is obviously a function in very important ways to what's happened since 2003, but it also was facilitated by what had happened from 1991 onward. And that kind of social disintegration, that kind of disorder, that kind of just this atomization of people is, I think, what fundamentally is facilitating ISIS. And it's not clear to me that the U.S. has a solution at hand to that, but more importantly, it's not clear to me that the U.S. understands the problem in those terms. And unless it comes to understand what's the problem in terms of social and political disintegration, I'm not, as opposed to mere sectarianism, I don't think anything the U.S. does will have any effect.
I mean,
any material or lasting effect, let me put it that way.
And do you think, I mean, is it, give me your sense as to whether or not this idea is valid, that in my mind, when we provide the unifying principle for ISIS and the Sunni tribes who are not necessarily aligned, I mean, intrinsically aligned with ISIS. In fact, many of them, I imagine, are rather upset about ISIS, but they're better than the Shia oppression that they have been subjected to. And when we talk about all the different disparate groups in Syria, it seems to me that U.S. bombing there, and I would put that in opposition to simply providing defensive operations in support of the Iraqi military and perhaps the Peshmerga as well, that we become the unifying principle and stand in the way of creating that state, that stronger state. And also, I guess, in conjunction with that, do you think the solution lies in perhaps three states in Iraq?
Well, I'm not sure what a solution looks like. The problem, I mean, the Turks, right, had three states in Iraq. We might be stepping back to history, stepping back to the Ottoman Empire, right? The problem with the three-state solution, if it's a solution, is that the Kurds get a viable state, and that's probably a just historical demand. The state would likely be viable. The Shia would get something that would work. The problem is the Sunnis don't get the oil. The oil is not, for the most part, located in regions where Sunnis are the majority, or even substantial minorities, except for the parts the Kurds have claimed in the areas they're contesting with the Iraqi government, as well as the local Sunnis. So it's not clear to me when people start talking about three states how the third of those three states is to survive economically. It might be possible to arrange for some kind of payments. I don't know. I do tend to think that before anybody gets serious about negotiating a solution to the conflict currently going on in Iraq, every side has to give up its hopes and dreams of victory. And I don't see any side giving up its ambitions of victory. You tend to get negotiations, you tend to get solutions to these kinds of problems when one of two things happens. One side wins and the other side or sides loses, or all sides give up hope of victory, and that takes a very, very long time to accomplish, because not only must the leaders of the existing sides give up hope of victory, but their more militant flanks have to give up hope of victory. And that takes a very long time. It's a very bloody, ugly, unsightly, awful, inhuman process. But that tends to be the way that these kinds of conflicts end, barring one side winning and the other side's losing. And quite right now, it's not clear to me how any side can mobilize the political power to win. I mean, ISIS is, or at least the Sunnis who are backing ISIS, have important foreign backers. I mean, Turkey doesn't want a Shia Iraq. It certainly doesn't want a Shia Iraq where the government secures its power by virtue of Iranian-backed Shia militias. And absolutely Saudi Arabia doesn't want that either. And both the Saudis and the Turks have the resources to funnel in to Sunnis, not necessarily ISIS Sunnis, but Sunnis to fight the Baghdad government. And the Baghdad government basically can't fight now, right? Who does the fighting against ISIS? It's the Shiite militias. And the Shiite militias are more, they're not wholly answerable to Iraq, to Iran, but they're more answerable to Iran than they are to the Iraqi government. One thing that Americans have not gotten their head around is what happened in Mosul. What happened in Mosul was not the ISIS, backed by the Sunnis, defeated the government. What happened was the army simply melted away. There were
something like 800 to 330,000.
Right. And now if you count the more broadly the numbers, it was 800 to 60,000.
Right.
The Iraqi army isn't an army. You have generals by their position. It's like something out of Goodfellas. The generals buy their positions, and they turn their units into protection rackets that shake down any traveler, any trucker, anybody else. They create ghost regiments. They're paid for the ghost soldiers. They split the money with the ghost soldiers. They demand payment from privates and from lieutenants, and the money goes up, and then kind of some of it sticks to the lieutenants kicked up by the privates and to the colonels kicked up by the lieutenants. And they don't provide the soldiers, such as they are, with basic goods such as water, food, guns, and ammunition. This isn't in any meaningful sense an army. It cannot fight like an army. It doesn't act like an army. In the absence of an army, in the absence of armed forces, the state isn't a state. The state has become dependent on backing either from Shiite militias, Kurds who want out, or foreign backers such as the U.S. who are trying to convince themselves that if you can get some Sunnis included in a Baghdad government, which has very little power to do anything other than loot, you'll have a political alternative to ISIS. And that just doesn't seem to me to be a very realistic response to a profound political crisis.
All of which
not a happy situation.
All of which a function of delusions of regime change in Iraq. Michael McDonald, thank you so much for your time today. We will put a link to your book at majority.fm.
Well, thank you very much. I had a great time.
All right, folks. We will head into the fun half of the program. Ben Affleck on Bill Maher's show, basically telling Bill Maher and Sam Harris, hey, you guys are being sort of douchebags. Sort of. Well, I think he sort of said that. And they were probably acting like full-throated douchebags. I'm not sure where the qualification lies in that. That's why we will play the tape in the fun half of the program. Also on the program, I think I mentioned last week that voter registration in and around Ferguson, Missouri has gone up 30% since Michael Brown was shot. And we got video of a protest which basically interrupts, and I can't tell if it actually started before or in the middle of the St. Louis Symphony, but protesters stood up and sang a requiem for Michael Brown, which was pretty impressive. Also sort of stunning response from some people in the audience. Also on the program, in the fun half, we will talk about the failure slash success of the Supreme Court to not deal with any of the marriage equality cases that they had or were petitioned to be heard by the Supreme Court, which means that in about a half a dozen states, almost automatically, marriage equality is law of the land. It's going to have broader implications, and I think we now have 60% of the country where marriage equality is legal. And so you know what that means. Tsunami coming. Hail the size of watermelons. Somewhere between grapefruits and watermelons.
That actually is coming. But not because of gay marriage.
Ah, well, marriage equality. All right. We have to work on the correlation versus causality issue on that. All that and more in the funner half. Again, we need your support. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. All right, folks, 646-257-3920. If you want to IM us, you can do so via the app or on your IM client at Majority FM. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. I'm going to go try and get some fluids in me, maybe an IV. Back in a moment.